Accession number 9420, reel 17.
Mr. Bill Gilman, reel 17. I believe you stayed on as secretary even after Stratford route, NUR, even after you'd left. Could you explain that?
Well, they didn't want me to give up as secretary because one of the reasons was, of course, I regarded it as a unique distinction because in my branch of the Stratford number 3 in NUR, it was composed of shopmen, and of course, in the engine repair shop where I worked, and which I had organised, and was mainly the branch membership with a few exceptions over at the running shed. They were composed of a lot of craftsmen, apart from myself as labourers or semi-skilled men. There was blacksmiths and fitters, boiler mounters, and every craft that you could mention that would be involved in to do with engines and engine repairing and engineering of any description. And of course, they elected me. They held elections for what they called the Stratford and Temple Mills Works Committee, which was for the whole of Stratford. You know, engine repair shop was only one big workshop, a tremendous place it was, because it used to carry the 1500 express engines along on the cranes inside it, so it'll give you an idea of the size of it. And but that was only a part of the Stratford Temple Mills, because they used to make their own carriages even. They had the carriage works and the boiler works and the boiler shop and the tenders. They used to make their own tenders. It's a very fully blown area and tremendous. And in the structure of industrial relations that took place between the management and the unions, they had this body called the Stratford and Temple Mills Works Committee, which were composed of delegates from each of the sections within Stratford. And I, which was one of the things I've been proud of right through my industrial life, it was elected as secretary to that body. For 2 years I remained secretary, and of course I was chief negotiator as well, so you can tell the confidence they had in me, because there were some very long-headed people in those craft unions. They were great blokes, some of them had joined the NUR, and much to the chagrin and annoyance of the official unions, the craft unions. But I even overcame that and established a good relationship, although I had accepted some of their members into my union where there was a difference, and some trouble had erupted for some reason or the other, which I never went into. But my job was to unite them and keep them together. And I insisted that we mustn't let personal considerations and upsets stand in the way of the general progress because of the economic position that we were in as a result of the strike. And I kept on punching that point that this was an aftermath of the strike, and that the employers as such, as a body, were antagonistic towards us. They were an enemy, and we had got to work with them and negotiate with them, and it was no good letting personal things interrupt our progress. And because of that, they had a lot of faith, and as I say, they elected me as their secretary. And even after I left, they still wanted me to carry on. But I refused to carry on as secretary of the Works Committee because of the constant day-to-day things, and I wasn't there, and I didn't think it was fair. But my own branch of Stratford number 3 NUR insisted that I carry on, and I did for 2 more years as the branch secretary, because I then wasn't involved, of course, in negotiations, which, of course, I thought was wrong. And I mean, outsider, you couldn't expect them. They were going to shoot me down in any case if I'd have gone in and I didn't work there. That one of the first things. Although it wouldn't have been a real valid objection because of my knowledge of the working conditions. But that was how that ended up. And I gave up the branch secretaryship. And as I say, I came over to the collectors, and I was still a member of the NUR for some time before we organised it, as I told you just now.
Could you tell us on tape how you came to organise the collectors into and took them into the Transport and General Workers Union? Because that wasn't recorded then.
Yes. Oh, well, what happened there was that when I left the railway eventually, and I think I told you in my last interview with you, that I'd told the Major Baister, the works manager, that I hoped to go back and congratulate him, and I did. 3 weeks after I'd started at the London Co-op and I'd got the weight of it, and I found that I was on my own, I found that, and I went back and told him, I said, I phoned him up, and he asked if I could see him. I didn't relate the circumstances, but I said it had to do with our previous relationship. And he said, by all means, Gilman, he said, come and have a cup of tea. Because I wasn't working for him then, and we were more or less strangers from outside, as it were. But he was that sort of man. And I went and saw him, and I said, well, I'm telling you, the reason I've come to see you, sir, I said, is because I was always very respectful to them, you know. It was always, sir, you know. It didn't matter who I was or what I was, but... because I always insisted when I was talking to them in negotiations, I always said, you're not negotiating with Mr. Gilman, you're negotiating now with the National Union of Railwomen. But anyway, when I went now, I said, I took this opportunity to come and congratulate you on having discharged me. I said, it may sound peculiar, I said, but if I tell you, I said, that I've now got a job where I work one day less a week than I did for the railway. I said, and on top of that, I get half as much again as I earned when I was working for the railway, admittedly due to my own efforts. But I said, you will realise why I've come to congratulate you on having discharged me. And he laughed. You know, he really rolled up over that. He could see the funny side of it. And... that was me. I mean, I wanted to push the point home, and that was the way I normally conducted even industrial negotiations. I suppose I made that way. But after that, of course, I stayed, as I told you, for another 2 years. I was in the NUR, and in that time I was finding out how hopeless it was in that collectors association, which they'd got, that hadn't any economic power. And we went on for some considerable time. I remember I went up with them on a couple of assignments, you know, negotiations. I couldn't get anywhere with the management there because we had no weight behind us, you see. They could talk us and all this kind of thing. And we didn't get anywhere.
Then the co-op management were just like any other management as far as you were concerned.
Oh, yeah, actually, they were ordinary people because the London Co-op were elected in their own organisations outside. They were they weren't official business organisations. As a matter of fact, I really think that the reason that the London Co-op or the cooperative movement as it is today in this area, which is covered by the old London Society and is now the Cooperative Retail Society, and it's dwindled away now, and I think the real reason that it is no longer a power as such that it was in the old days and so democratic is because they were ordinary people, and they hadn't got the business training and acumen that is needed to run a business. And I think it's tragic. It's the old story, and it's even reflecting itself in local government now, as I was speaking to you privately a little while back, you know, that... the amateurs come along and they think they can run it far better than the trained officials and the people and the staff who are trained, similar to your own job. I mean, people can't come along and tell you how to run this. I mean, I'd be hopeless at operating this the way you were recording this. I said, I wouldn't dream of interfering and tell you how you should run it and the sequence. And this is what happened, and it's a tragic thing, but there you are. And
how did you decide which union to take the collectors into, having decided to get a union? Could you tell me that again?
Oh, well, I thought I mentioned to you on that.
Not on tape, you see.
Wasn't it? Oh, well, what happened was that when I got there and found that this was an association of people who were all like myself, members of other trade, of their own trade union, and had, as a result, aftermath of the strike, and like me, had been discharged and lost their jobs. And they got these books of for the co-op, were doing the same job as I was. They're very well organised, but they had no economic power behind them when they went to discuss or negotiate things with the management of the London Co-op Society, who themselves, as I say, were elected people, were within their own organisation. There was what they called a 1960 committee, and there was also the LCMO, which was the London Cooperative Members Association, members organisation, and they used to put up candidates to go on the committee, you know, and that happens to this day. But I noticed that in last week's results that there was no opposition at all, and everybody, about 32 of them, committees, had all got elected unopposed. A thing I've never met before in all my history of organisation, political and otherwise. Anyway, what happened was that I came to the conclusion pretty quickly that we weren't getting anywhere through this collectors' organisation, and I suggested to them that we join a fully registered trade union. And the three that we selected were the Transport and General Workers Union, which was the biggest of the lot, General and Municipal Workers, which was the second biggest, and also ASDAL, which was the Shop Workers Union, and what regarded more or less as the cooperative employees union, as it is to the present day, because it's the shop workers union. And we had a good deal of money in the bank at that time. I think running into hundreds anyway. It was about 800, I think, or 600, I think. I'm not quite sure now. And we decided to use that as a bargaining point to get the best conditions to go into one of these unions. And we finished up by joining the Transport and General Workers Union, because it was the largest union and had the most economic weight. And we decided to go into that and give them the finances that we had on conditions that they registered our membership as trade union members right back to the days of our previous joining of the previous union that we belonged to, because we all had to come out of that and join the Transport and General Workers Union. And it didn't conflict with the Bridlington Agreement of the TUC, because we were then out of a job and we weren't eligible to remain. So that's what we did. And of course I was elected as the branch secretary of the number one branch. We were six branches we had, and we were very well organised, and we had a negotiating committee, and it was ironical, and the first very good instance of what democracy is about, and I'm very fond of relating, that as an employee of the London Co-op Society, I had to lead a deputation to ask for an improvement of conditions and increases in our remuneration. And on the other hand, at that time, I was on the council, on the finance committee, and I had to meet the chairman of, when I was putting the collector's case, as the chairman of the London Co-op board. And when I was back on the council, on my committees, The chairman himself was also an employee of my council in the Treasurer's Department. So I was the employee when I went to him for the collectors. He was my employee, you might say, or one of them, when he was on the council, and it was his turn to put in applications with his colleagues for improvements. So that's how it worked out. It was very funny, really, but that's how democracy works.
From this whole time during the 20s and 30s, can you remember any of the major figures of the political life of London?
Yes, very clearly, because I took a leading part because I was, as I say, I was chairman of the West End Trades Council, and I was also very active in the 30s, if you're including that period, when I was elected onto the West End Council. Of course, I had the pleasure of enjoying the presence of the four MPs, which were very famous people at the time.
And what can you remember about each of them?
Well, there was four well-known people in the history books, if you've been through it, of Labour Party, all Labour men. One was Jack Jones, that was for Silvertown. He was known famously by his clash with Lady Esther.
You said that. What else do you remember about Jack Jones? How did you get on with him personally?
I got on with him very well, although he slapped me down at the beginning because I got up and asked a lot of questions, and first I made one or two comments, and I shouldn't have because I was only a kid and a junior member of the council, and he was one of those who slapped me down and said if my young friend had been on the council a little longer, he wouldn't ask questions like that, he wouldn't make statements like that. So thereafter, I learnt that lesson very early on, because he was not the only one who said it to me, but I was very quick in making statements on subjects that really I shouldn't have done, because I was learning then. My early days of the council, made the common mistake of youngsters, of course the result of it was that I confined myself to asking questions, and I got a lot more information because they were there and they had to answer the questions, because in some cases they were also chairman of certain committees. In those days, although no one got paid, the honour was equivalent to being paid when they became chairman. It was quite an important job. And there was, of course, I remember he had a battle with Motsfield, who was the sole member of the West End Council of 64 members, who was a representative of the NUWM, which was the Unemployed Workers Movement, the so-called rebel organisation. It wasn't really a political organisation, but it was composed in those times of this disgruntled people who thought they could shift the world by having an organisation of their own. And they operated under the NUW. It was composed of all sorts of people. I know they used to go out with a barrel organ round the streets of West Ham. And I caught them once undoing the money boxes and pocketing the money. It wasn't going to the organisation at all, and they didn't like it when I found it out, and I told them off about it. It wasn't my business because it was their organisation, but they were using the church hall that I got them from through the good offices of the council, which I'd used my membership of to get them this old church hall mission to use for their headquarters. But there was, of course, that occasion when he had a fisticuff battle in the council chamber with Paddy Motsfield, we had to separate them. I remember because we had curtains up alongside then, and they were behind the curtains. They were scuffling. We had to go and separate them because Jack was fiery-tempered, as well as Paddy Motsfield. And then the other occasion was the Daisy Parsons, who was a friend of Sylvia Pankhurst and took active part in the suffragette movement at that time. and or during that period anyway. And of course, I remember her. She smashed a minute book across the head of the Alderman Ramsey, who was an MM and bar at that time. And they were sitting opposite one another, and because he called her a cow, and because she hit him across the head. She was fiery tempered, as a lot of them were at that time, in the council chamber. It made quite a big press in article and rumpus about it at the time. And I remember too, on one occasion, you talk about celebrities, that when Stafford Cripps was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, we invited him from the Trades Council angle, because it was still a bad economic period, you know, when it was when the second Labour government got in. Stafford Cripps was Chancellor at that time, and we invited him to the Stratford Town Hall, place I was at yesterday, when the Queen came along and reopened it for its centenary. And of course, the place was packed out. Well, not only the West End Trades Council members were there, and all the various organisations and the unions, because we made it well known that Stafford Cripps was coming there, and everybody was after his blood because of the attitude he took on the economic situation in the country, and trying to get it straightened out, because we were in a terrible state at the time. And I remember that after he'd made his speech to this house, they gave him the very good attention. There was no interruptions or anything. And, I wouldn't know that, because I was presiding at the meeting. And I was always banged down on that. I wouldn't let, even if I didn't like the person who was talking or what they said, I always insisted on having a clear field. And after he'd spoken, we went backstage. He said, what did you think of it, Mr. Gilman? And he's very courteous and very aristocratic sort of man, really, in his attitude. And I said, well, Sir Stafford, I said, I think that you really spoke over their heads, I said, and I didn't think they could come up to the level you were speaking of. And he said, well, he said, it's up to them to raise themselves to their, to raise themselves up a bit, wasn't it? So I said, well, I said, of course, you're in West Ham now. I said, this is an industrial borough. I said, and where you've got people here from the docks and the railways, I said, and all the factories around, I said, they can't reach the level, I said, that you reached, I said, in your speech. I said, but I think they probably got the message that you were putting over. He said, well, I hope they did. And of course, that was one of the episodes that always stood out in my mind then.
What about the MP for Plaistow?
Then there was Bill Thorne. Of course, he was a famous figure. He had four wives, and he lived till he was in his 90s, you know. And he used to go and stand outside the tavern at Plaistow there and address the Sunday morning crowd. And it was a real old cut and thrust business of public meetings. And of course, I think it was getting on to that. I'm not quite sure of the period now when, of course, there was, what was his name with the black shirts?
Mosley,
yes, Roswell Mosley. Well, of course, he came down and with his black shirts to Forest Gate and the leather jackets and the jack boots and all this kind of thing, and they marched down there, and there were scuffles, and we slung them out of the town hall on one occasion, because I threatened to have the hose turned on them if they didn't get out, because the fire station was right next door. And I don't think we did turn the hose on them, but I did threaten, because I was one of the speakers at the meeting, Oh, was I? No, I wasn't speaker at the meeting. It because it was a black shirt meeting. Of course, it was. It was one of the meetings that Mosley called. He was calling them all over the borough, and they used to definitely go down to the end outside Forest Gate Station and make that a mark, because the Labour Party, my ward, used to hold meetings down there by the fountain, which has been removed now. And outside Forest Gate Station, they came down there to try and interrupt us once and twice, and there was several battles that went on. And they were a real menace, the National Front. They weren't known as the National Front then. Forget the name that they used to call them in those days. But it was quite lively. I mean, we had some...
Would you organise to counsel, to counter Mosley's black shirts? Did you deliberately counter them?
Well, as soon as we got to here, they were going to have meetings. I mean, we all warned the members of not to avoid. I used to tell them not to avoid conflicts, and my colleagues didn't always agree with me on that. And I didn't think that it would accomplish anything, because, for one thing, they were unscrupulous crowd, and that was the nature of their organisation, you know, and they were brutal with it all, and it was the usual thing on contacts and conflicts of any kind like that. It's normally the innocent people who suffer, and not the people who are directly interested in it, that suffer from these things. And that was why I always warned our people to try and avoid, if there was trouble brewing and they sensed it at all, to clear off, not to take part in it. And it worked to a great extent, because some of our members came back to the meeting sometimes who stuck around, and I had an idea that they carried one or two sticks with them, and they used to complain about getting knocked about, you know, in these little brushes that they had with the black shirts.
You were never...
I was never personally involved in it, no. I didn't take part because I didn't think that was a definitive objective at all, to have meetings like that. I never did. It's the same as these demonstrations with the banners. It's all very well if they're peaceable, they're confined to the one object they stand for. But demonstrations nowadays, of course, I mean, I don't know whether it's relevant to an interview like this, but I don't know whether you're aware of it, but I think you must be, that organisations that have got absolutely nothing whatever to do with the originators of these demonstrations hitch onto with their banners, and they depict all sorts of organisations and mushroom growths that have got nothing whatever to do with the original purpose, and they rather spoil the effect of a good demonstration like that by shouting slogans that have got nothing whatever to do with the object. I mean, what spoils it?
How did you get on with Ben Gardner or Tom Groves, the other two MPs?
Oh, I was I was a personal friend of all of them. I mean, I knew them quite well because, apart from me being on the same council with them, the council meetings and having a natter, and we had, believe it or not, now you'll hardly credit this, when I went on the council in 1933, the general annual reception, mayor's reception was held every year at the town hall, and at that time, believe it or not, we had our dress was white tie and tails. Now, you'd never credit it. This was a Labour borough, a socialist borough. It had never been anything else. And there we were, and I got a suit made by a Pope.